Movie Buff Specialist Phil and John are back as we continue going through our 100 favorite movies of all time. Today we're discussing number 13 on both of our lists, episode number 88, Fargo from 1996, Dr. Strangelove from 1964. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, I know we have a Casablanca Mulholland Drive episode coming up soon, but I believe that this is the highest for both movies. Like, I think this is the podcast that we both have these movies very high on our list. I think that if you were to like look at the average or whatever you want to call that, you had Strangelove at 40. I have it at 13. You have Fargo at 13. I have it at 59, I believe. But if you averaged out both of those, I think this is the highest we have both movies on both of our lists. If that has a better wording, somebody else can come up with it because it's not going to be me. But this is a big episode. And I watched both movies last night, did a double feature of it. And very pleased with my taste in movies. That's all I'll say.
Yeah, I mean, these two are just, there's a reason both of these movies are on our top 100s as high as we have them.
Yeah, and I think there's a reason why these two movies still get discussed so much, especially Fargo. I mean, obviously Fargo had the TV series made after it, the anthology series, which is great. If you haven't watched the anthology series, the anthology series is phenomenal. I think season two is the best one. But they're all great. And season two with Kirsten Dunst and Jesse Plemons is just weird, even from a Fargo, from a Coen standpoint. But what's fun about that show is that you get to expand on the world of this. And what's amazing about the movie is that the Coen brothers made something so iconic that's 98 minutes long and pretty much changed the way people view the Midwest. But Dr. Strangelove is also only 95 minutes long. So we're talking about two of the shortest movies we have here and two movies that have absolutely stood the test of time. And it's amazing what these directors, and I mean, Stanley Kubrick, Joel Coen, Joel Coen's the only one who actually directed Fargo. People forget that it wasn't actually technically the Coen brothers, but we'll call it a Coen brothers movie because whatever. But Strangelove and Fargo in the hands of these two iconic directors, and they did so much in so little and were able to get such a point across and such a message across. And I think that's what makes these two movies so powerful. And it kind of goes back to showing, like, you don't need to make nothing but 3-hour epics. You don't need to put padding in to make what could be a 2-hour movie, 2 hours and 25 minutes. We see that a lot these days, not as much editing, but Fargo and Dr. Strangelove show you can pretty much do whatever you want in a short amount of time.
Yeah. I think these are two of the prime examples of using every second you have in a film to perfectly demonstrate every idea you want, because both of these movies are fairly well contained when it comes down to it. They're not over long. You can show these movies to everyone and almost everyone will like them. Strangelove might go over some people's heads, but
Strangelove, I have found people generally have had a harder time with when I've sat down and watched it.
Yeah, I mean, like, there are people who just don't like movies that are that old or in black and white, and it's weirder. But in the end, like, both of these movies have these central themes that they talk about, and they articulate them so well in their short runtimes, and it really does go to show that time in a film is kind of just an illusion sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that what also makes these such compelling movies is how short of a time period each one does take place in. Like, like Dr. Strangelove, I think takes place over the course of what, probably 3 hours, if that, if you really think about it, because Sterling Hayden makes the call and everything starts happening. And then they say, okay, we got like 20 minutes before this is going to go down. And I mean, they have to get everybody over there and whatever, but I think like this might take place within the span of an hour. I don't really know if it's any longer than that. So Dr. Strangelove's like that. And then Fargo is a pretty quick moving mystery movie because we see all the violence happen on the first night. And by the time Marge Gunderson actually figures it out, it's probably in the course of a week, something like that. And it's nice to see the time that's actually taking place on screen match the length of time that the movies are, because sometimes we see, I mean, Magnolia is a 3-day movie and it's over 3 hours long. And I'm not going to complain about that because it's one of my favorite movies of all time. But sometimes people try to drag out these, oh, it all takes place in the course of one night. Then why is your movie like 5 hours long. You know, it can be shorter. It can be condensed. And Fargo and Strangelove are both condensed. And they're actually very interesting because neither one of them in the hands of a lesser director has enough to warrant a feature length film. I don't know if you agree with that or disagree with that, but I really realized that watching Fargo this time. Fargo is not an hour and a half long movie unless it's in the hands of the Coen brothers.
Yeah, I mean, there's all those little details in Fargo that string it out, but if you can summarize this plot pretty succinctly for both of these films, and especially Fargo, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's start with Dr. Strangelove, though, and, okay, you know, we can do 25 minutes since we pretty much talked about both of these for 5 minutes, but Dr. Strangelove comes in at number 13 for me. So Stanley Kubrick's my favorite director of all time. This is my favorite Stanley Kubrick movie. I had Space Odyssey not far behind it. I have A Clockwork Orange on my top 100. I love Barry Lyndon. After I rewatched Paths of Glory, Paths of Glory is 100% in my top 100. It's not even close. Full Metal Jacket's a movie that's always missing that cut right at the end. And then you have like The Killing, which is a 4-star movie. And you have Lolita, which is pretty good. Probably Spartacus is my least favorite out of like his real movies, because Killer's Kiss and what do you call it? The other one that I can't even think of the name of right now. They're not really there. But all of that to say, and Eyes Wide Shut is maybe one of the most underrated movies of all time, which has now grown in popularity as we've moved away from it. But it was very much like, it was almost like Babylon at the time it came out, where people didn't really know what to make of it. And without Kubrick there to talk about why it was good, nobody really believed it. But Dr. Strangelove gets the nod for me. And I think the thing with Dr. Strangelove is, Dr. Strangelove to me, and a lot of people disagree with me on this, but I think it's the most palatable of Stanley Kubrick's movies. This is the easiest one to sit down and digest. Eyes Wide Shut has orgies and whatever else, and it's a weird meandering story. Tom Cruise walks around for like an hour of the movie. I mean, it's a weird movie. A Clockwork Orange is just too violent for some people. Space Odyssey is too weird for some people. And Spartacus is so generic when you actually break it down to what that movie is for that time. It might have seemed groundbreaking, but Ben-Hur came out before it, and Ben-Hur, in my opinion, is a much better movie. And that's from a Kubrick fan who really doesn't care when it comes to William Wyler. So all of that being said, I think Dr. Strangelove is the most straightforward movie that Stanley Kubrick ever made. And I sat there last night watching this movie. I hadn't seen it in like 5 years. And I had the biggest smile on my face the entire time. From the opening part about the U.S. Air Force has something to protect this, this will never happen, to deep in Russia, this is what's happening, and they're introducing the doomsday machine and all that, to just Jack D. Ripper going around and doing what he needs to do to make sure that Wing Attack Plan R is put into effect. And what I love about this movie is it really just emphasizes the idiocy and the stupidity and the blind trust that we as human beings put into the government and the military and things like that, where even the military and the government don't know what the hell they're doing half the time. Because we see General Ripper put this plan into effect, and every time they say, oh, well, why don't we just do this? Well, we can't, sir. We can't. They cut off communications. They did this. They stopped that. They did this. Oh, well, we'll just go to the base then and we'll kill him. Well, if you go to the base, he's going to shoot at you because that's what they're trained to do, because they think you're communist now. Like, it's just pure nonsense. And then we hear the Russian point of view, which is, well, if we get nuked, we're just going to have the doomsday machine go off. Like, there's nothing anybody can do about it. And I love how it just leans into how all of these fail safes and all of these brilliant minds that we think, they actually put together plans that if they ever did have to go into effect, would just cause the destruction of the world. And we see that with, I laughed so hard at the part with Merkin Muffley sitting there saying, no, Dimitri, shoot them down. We're behind you 100%. Because we have the president of the United States telling the Russians to shoot down his plane to prevent a nuclear war. And it's funny because we hear all these conspiracy theories and whatever, and I'm using air quotes because, you know, it's conspiracy theory, conspiracy theory, conspiracy theory. In today's world, everything's a conspiracy theory, no matter what side of the political spectrum you're on. Everybody has political conspiracy theories. And yet, there's a little bit of truth to every conspiracy theory, right? Like, at least there's a little bit of truth. I'm not saying that they're like 90% true. I'm saying like everything's got about 1% of truth behind it, because there is something that is making people feel that way. And Dr. Strangelove just shows that. And if Jack D. Ripper had Twitter, oh my God, he would have a following. That's all I'll say.
Yeah, I mean, Kubrick with this movie is really critiquing the idea of mutually assured destruction anyways, but showing it through this incompetence of the military and the politicians. So much so, now this might be a rumor, but I've heard that policies towards these type of missions were changed because of the depiction in this film.
Oh, I believe it. I don't know if that's true or not, but I believe it, because there were definitely, you have to think nowadays you can get in touch. You can, I mean, we could hit somebody with a missile from a satellite if we wanted to, to stop them from starting a nuclear war. But in 1964, the whole fear was we can't catch it on radar. We don't know where they're stationed. We can't see it. Like we hadn't gotten to the point where we're at now where you could see everything. I mean, we're probably being watched right now while we do this podcast by somebody from a satellite. I hope somebody's watching us. That'd be great. But I would believe that this would have changed the way people put things into effect. Because as ridiculous as the premise of this movie is, it's not ridiculous at all. General Ripper is an over-the-top character, but characters like General Ripper exist. And somehow they find their way up into higher ranks of the military just because they're in there long enough. They go through officer training or whatever it is, and now all of a sudden they're a general. And what is it? The war shouldn't be fought by the politicians. War is too important to be fought by the generals. I disagree. I think war is too important to be fought by the politicians. And it's like, that's what we see in this movie. And in reality, what we're seeing is war is too important to be fought by either of them. They don't know what the hell they're doing, because you got the bloodthirsty generals and you got the politicians who are bumbling over themselves. The part where George C. Scott is talking about, well, if we had a good pilot, if he was really good, he could fly right there under them and fire at those Ruskies, and he's going on and on. And then he realizes, holy shit, they are that good. They could blow this whole thing up, but he's so excited about it because those are his boys. It's just, it just shows the stupidity on both sides of everything. And I think that's what was great about Kubrick when he made these anti-war movies, because this was his second in a series of three, Paths of Glory, this, and of course, Full Metal Jacket, which was anti-Vietnam. But what was so brilliant about when he did those was you felt something. And he was manipulating you to feel that way, but he wasn't telling you exactly how to feel. You still had to think of it for yourself. I mean, I'm sure there's people who watch this movie and completely agree that fluoridation is the reason that commies are taking over the world. Like, I don't know. Maybe there is. Maybe there isn't. I'm sure there's somebody out there who believes that. But Kubrick just keeps pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing to the point where you're just like, okay, like, I get it. War is stupid, and everybody who's involved in it is stupid. Whether they're Russian, American, the president, a general, the ambassador, or Dr. Strangelove. It does not matter. They're all stupid.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the most important things that makes Dr. Strangelove so good, is that it doesn't come across as this Cold War era propaganda film from Kubrick. And it's just critiquing everything in general. It's critiquing everything about the Cold War, essentially, and saying, this is ridiculous. If we're living in a world where we're just going to nuke each other to oblivion, like, what is the point of this game we're playing, essentially? And Kubrick even put green felt on the table in the war room in this black and white movie to make the actors feel like they're playing a game over the fate of the world.
Mm. I like that. I like that. See, I didn't know that. That's a cool little tidbit, because it's true. Like, some of the shots that they use and everything in this, it does seem like they're all sitting around how you would see, they're playing a giant game of Risk. But it's on the big board, sir. It's on the big board. It's on the big board. That's a fun way to look at it. And I think what's cool about this too is that in all the different storylines that are going on, you have Peter Sellers in two of them, playing Merkin Muffley and playing Mandrake. And he's obviously Dr. Strangelove, but Dr. Strangelove is such a secondary character in this, and we'll talk about him to the point where he's like a tertiary character, but we'll talk about him. But you have those and you have Slim Pickens, and it's comedic, 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 comedic. George C. Scott was not a comedic actor, although he gives one of the great comedic performances ever in this movie. He wasn't nominated for an Oscar, which is a crime against humanity. And John and I were talking about it before this podcast. it would have been okay if they didn't nominate him because they nominated Sterling Hayden, but they didn't nominate Sterling Hayden either. They just didn't nominate either one of them. At least Peter Sellers got nominated and somehow lost. I think he lost to Rex Harrison. But when you look at the decisions that are being made there, by having a really heavy comedic presence in each one, and obviously Mandrake isn't the comedic presence of the Jack Ripper Mandrake storyline, but you have a comedic actor who understands being a straight man and being the joke man. And that, I think, elevates the absurdity of the movie each time and keeps it so that it still feels surreal and out of touch with reality, even though parts of you are saying, this could totally be happening, couldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the realism on the B-52 sequences, I mean, part of it comes down to the fact that Slim Pickens wasn't told this was a parody and a satire. He wasn't told. He was just thought he was making a war movie. And it comes across that way in his performance and in everything that happens in that B-52. It's so serious. And despite the fact that we, as the audience, are seeing the wild escapades that are happening behind the scenes, they just know they have a mission and they have to complete it to the point that when they start leaking fuel, they have to change their target to accommodate just because they can.
Well, and that's what I love is how well plotted this movie is for as short as it is. Ripper does what he does. Now, all of a sudden, they got to come up with a plan. George C. Scott gets the call. Buck Turgidson is his name, of course. Gets the call, has to go to the war room, join the president. The president's got to get on the phone with Dimitri. But there's this plane. And why have we chosen this plane of all the planes? We know that there's 34 planes. And so why have we chosen this one? And what we realize is, okay, well, Slim Pickens is ready to do it. Like, Slim Pickens, he's just that gung-ho. I mean, they couldn't have cast it better for that role. Again, Slim Pickens could have been nominated for the Oscar for this movie. Like, Slim Pickens was a perfect casting here because he's such a stereotype of American military. He's so over the top and he puts on his cowboy hat when it's time to get serious. And that's just fantastic. And then we realize, okay, they have now been hit by the missile right before the recall code comes in. So they don't know that they're being recalled. But then they come up with a plan. Okay, well, Dimitri, if you shoot your missiles at them, you can't miss. You know where they're going. And then we find out, well, they're losing fuel faster than they thought, so they actually have to target someplace closer. And it's those brilliant decisions that keep this movie going, because there is no chance in this movie. There's no, oh, well, we couldn't think of something, so just trust us, audience. Like, there is a reason why everything that happens in this movie happens the way it does and the nuclear war starts. It's a comedy of errors. That's what it is. And it just keeps getting worse and worse and worse every time for everybody involved, to the point where America doesn't even realize they're about to blow up Russia or any part of Russia because they think that plane's going to be shot down and they're totally fine with it. And that comes to the brilliance of the title, but I digress. I'll let you speak before I get into the brilliance, the absolute brilliance of this title.
So the interesting thing with Slim Pickens, you know, he wasn't originally supposed to play Major Khan.
Who was supposed to play Major Khan?
Peter Sellers.
What did I just say to you, right? He would have been in all three parts then.
Mm-hmm. And he didn't get it because he couldn't get the Texas accent now.
Mm-hmm.
So they replaced him. And like Kubrick reached out to a few people and it just settled on Slim Pickens. And Slim Pickens, I read that James Earl Jones thought Slim Pickens was just staying in character the entire time on set until he realized that's just who Slim Pickens is.
That's who Slim Pickens is. I know. Slim Pickens wasn't a good actor. That's the best part, right? Like, Slim Pickens was not a good actor, but he fit this role perfectly because he wasn't really acting. He thought he was making a serious movie, and that's the performance he gave.
Yeah, exactly. But everything about this, the contrast Kubrick puts into this film makes it work even better. The fact that these three storylines are going on, and we see the discombobulated politicians of it all, just like trying to figure out how to stop this. Then we have the straight and narrow B-52 crew doing their thing. But then we have the Jack the Ripper and Mandrake sequence where we get the discussion. And like that's the interesting thing about how all three of these plots are kind of tied in together, is that we get like the opposite sides of the spectrum plus the middle ground of the spectrum.
Yeah. Yep. And like these to have these three stories and show so much of them, right? So that we as the audience have so much information from each one. Like we know everything we need to know. And we'll talk about that with Fargo, because Fargo makes a decision to show you who the killers are and who they killed and how everything went down before then you jump into the point of view of the cop. Yeah. And Dr. Strangelove lets us know exactly what's going on, but it also lets us know that there's going to be doubt planted in anybody's head who comes into the situation, because it's explained to us why nobody's going to trust anybody. So like to tell us everything, to, you know, show us some in extremes and some of it in reality and whatever, it's fantastic decision-making. And Red Alert, the book this is based on, is a very serious communist book. Like it's very serious about like the fear of a communist threat in America. And Kubrick wanted to do that. He wanted it to be serious and he couldn't get it to work. So he said, we're making a comedy. We're making a comedy. It's going to work better that way. And he made it into a satire rather than making it whatever. But it's a very smart decision.
Yeah, it works even better, I think. Because I think if this movie was serious, I don't think it would be as good. I think it needs to be that satire. I think this topic is so... The funny thing about this movie, other than the fact that it's absolutely hilarious, is that while you're laughing at it, there's still that nagging voice in the back of your head is like, oh my God, this could actually happen. And like the fear of everything that's going on. And that's what makes a black comedy so great, is that it's playing on both that primal fear, but also the absurdity of it all.
Yeah, it's taking it to that next level. And this comes into the brilliance of the title. So everybody just calls this movie Dr. Strangelove, but the full title is Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. And when you first read that, you're like, oh, okay, cool. Like, you know, it's a satire. It's a movie that's like a joke about, you know, nuclear war and everything like that. But the brilliance of this is in that moment after Slim Pickens rides a nuclear warhead into the earth and is waving his hat above his head like he's riding a horse or a bull, we cut back, and all of a sudden, the bomb doesn't seem like such a bad idea. We're going to have 10 women for every man. We're going to live underground. We'll all have the food. We're going to have to make some necessary sacrifices. But of course, we'll take all the politicians and the military people, because those are who are most important. So we're going to do that. And who's giving them all this information? It's Dr. Strangelove. So Dr. Strangelove... Or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. For the first time all movie, they are not worried about the Russian threat. What are they worried about? They're worried about, we can't have the cave divide, or whatever they call it. The mineshaft gap. The mineshaft gap. Thank you. They can't have the mineshaft gap. But they're thinking already about, okay, the bomb has happened. They're not worried about the bomb anymore. They have finally given up because of Dr. Strangelove. And that's when the ambassador goes over and blows up the whole thing. Like it wasn't going to happen, but Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. Dr. Strangelove is how they learned to stop worrying and love the bomb. And it's just such a brilliant title, because it literally happens in the last minute of this movie. You know, obviously then we have the explosions with Vera Lynn beautifully singing We'll Meet Again. But before that, like the last actual minute of the movie that features actors, that's when they're learning to stop worrying. The whole movie, you feel like, oh, that's what the point is going to be, or it's just a catchy title. No, he literally tells you what's going to happen at the end of the movie.
Yeah.
With the title of this movie.
Yeah, I never really thought of it that way, but that's exactly how it works. And the impressive thing about the end of this film is Peter Sellers almost improvised this entire movie.
I know.
And you can tell in this last sequence when his, like, right hands start acting up and stuff. If you watch Peter Bull, he cannot.
He's laughing the whole time.
He is laughing the whole time as Peter Sellers starts like Nazi saluting and strangling himself.
And when he's wheeling the chair in the circle, that's when Peter Bull laughs the hardest. He can't hold it. And then he straightens his face up like he's real serious. But you're looking at Peter Sellers, so it's not as big of a deal. And Kubrick kept it in the movie.
Yeah. Because apparently, I mean, we all know Kubrick likes perfection in his scenes, but Peter Sellers is like, I can't do this more than like three times. That's all you're getting.
Yeah. Yeah. And it works. I mean, you can't complain, but we all know Kubrick is such a perfectionist. This is the only movie he ever made where he did allow for those kinds of things. It is. It's the only one because, I mean, obviously Jack Nicholson has talked about how much of an asshole Stanley Kubrick was on the set of The Shining. And we've heard so many stories about Kubrick, especially as he started to become a bigger name, about how he would just pretty much torture these actors with, nope, that wasn't good enough. Nope, that wasn't good enough. Nope, that wasn't good enough. Nope, that wasn't. And in this movie, obviously the most famous one of them all is when George C. Scott turns and falls. And he falls, but he keeps doing the scene and he points up at the big board and Kubrick says, we're going to keep it. That was the only time, I'm pretty sure, it's the only time in a Stanley Kubrick movie that he did not say, go ahead and improvise it or this is what's planned, and kept it in the movie. Like, if he told you to improvise, that was fine. That's what he told Jack Nicholson with Here's Johnny. He said, figure out a line that's going to make sense. And he said, here's Johnny, because he was so frustrated. And Kubrick said, great, we're going to keep that. But this was the only time where he didn't say improvise and he didn't say you can fall. And George C. Scott just fell but stayed in character. And it's such a Buck Turgidson moment. So how could you cut that from the movie? It's one of the funniest parts of the whole movie.
It is, because Buck Turgidson, the character of Buck Turgidson and George F. Scott's performance throughout it is so funny because he is so militaristic and so paranoid about the secrets that are kept in clearly labeled documents, and there's a giant board behind them that shows everything.
Mm-hmm.
And he's so paranoid about it, with letting in the Russian ambassador and everything, that he goes and, I mean, do you think he actually tried to plant that matchbox camera?
No, I think it was the Russian ambassador. Yeah.
But it's at the point where you're like, yeah, I totally can believe that this guy is trying to plant this because he's so suspicious of him. And that character just kind of encapsulates the general public's fear of communism at that point. Because we have, like, the massive extent when we get to General Ripper with his, like, you know, fluoride in the water and everything, spreading communism. It seems it's egregious. It's egregious to think that. It's so far-fetched. But everything that Turgidson says seems so reasonable in comparison to it.
Yeah. And the funniest part is, in 1964, things were to that level, right? Not necessarily with the fluoride, but the biggest reason why we see movies like Invasion of the Body Snatchers and Them and They Live and, like, all that, the reason that those movies exist is because of the fear of communism. Yep. Because the communists could be anybody walking around next to you. And they were going to ruin the American way of life. And that was what the fear was. So Jack D. Ripper is just amplifying that take by saying, they don't drink water, they drink vodka. They drink nothing but. And it's funny, though, because in what, 1997 or 1998, Men in Black comes out. And all the alien does is eat sugar. He doesn't want water. He doesn't want anything. He just wants sugar, 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 sugar. And it's kind of playing on that alien feeling of what we don't know. They must do what is going to be the thing that they do differently that makes them different from us, right? And for him, it's they drink vodka. That's why I only drink distilled rainwater, or no, rainwater and distilled grain alcohol. That's all I drink.
So funny.
It's so ridiculous. But people like that exist. I mean, the people like that who are these conspiracy theorists, doomsday guys, like, this is what happens. And this movie just says, now what happened if that person had all the power in the world to literally end the world?
Yeah. Yeah. And we see the benefits of Ripper's paranoia when he immediately confiscates all the radios, because he's like, nope, those are just broadcasts and give secret sabotage things. And we see the extent to that he believes that everyone can be communist, because he's like, they'll probably show up in military uniforms.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone kind of just, like, he's perfectly encapsulating that McCartney era Red Scare, right?
Yeah. Well, and what do they say? Wow, these guys are really good. Yeah, well, they told us they were going to look just like us, and they just start shooting at them. Like, it's fantastic. It's fantastic. And then I love, too, because then when Mandrake does say, hey, I know this, I know that, whatever. And I also like that Mandrake figures it out, and it makes sense how he figures it out because of purity of essence and peace on earth and all that stuff. But I love that when that's happening, the guy who finds him doesn't trust him. Because why should he trust him? why should he trust them? He's been told not to, and he's been told that everybody on this base is whatever. Everybody is against each other. And I think that's right. You could say what you want about United States of America and our society and our thus for them and whatever we feel with China, where now we have like balloons flying over us. I almost called it a spy balloon. Is it a spy balloon? Is it not a spy balloon? Who the hell knows? Who cares? But we have this flying over us. And this movie is portraying these planes are literally flying 24 hours a day, right on the edge of going to be able to bomb Russia. And we know that there's behind the scenes discussions going on. But it's like when you look at what American society is right now, what is it? It's Democrat versus Republican. And China is the big bad over there, right? That's what it kind of feels like in America. This movie, made 60 years ago pretty much at this point, is all about how you don't need to be fighting the enemy if you're fighting yourself, because you're going to find a way to destroy yourselves anyway. Democrat versus Republican, you're just destroying yourselves anyway. Like, that's all. You're just destroying yourselves anyway because you're so worried fighting about each other that you're not even worried about what's actually happening outside. You know, that's the arrogance of the United States. There's 300 million of us and we think we're the whole world. But I digress, and I just think it's interesting that Dr. Strangelove, made so long ago, I mean, the themes and everything are just identical. They're just identical. It's the same stuff. And I read a review on Letterboxd that said, you know, they didn't get the movie. Maybe it's because they didn't grow up with the Cold War fear, and maybe their parents didn't, and something like that. I disagree with that because I think this movie is about any war. Yes, it fits with the Cold War, but I think this is about any war, because right now we're kind of in our own Cold War, right? We can't say anything to Russia. We can't say anything to China. China can't say anything to us. Russia can't say anything to us. People are worried all over Europe and here and South America, whatever it is. Everything. You hear about socialism and it's bad. Communism and it's bad. Capitalism and it's bad. Everything is bad. And that's what Dr. Strangelove is getting across at the end of the day, is like, everybody is so scared of everything just because they're hearing it that they just want to fight and go to war with everybody, and they feel like they should be in war. And we got to shoot down these balloons because we're scared that they're trying to steal our intelligence or whatever it is. It doesn't matter. It's just, it's the fear. It's the worry. Yeah. And it's the fighting amongst yourselves. And that's what Dr. Strangelove is about. And it doesn't matter if it's the Cold War or Vietnam or World War II or World War I or the war in Iraq or whatever we're in right now. It's still relevant. It's just still so relevant. And we might have a general on an Air Force base in America right now who really believes that people in China are trying to steal our precious bodily fluids.
Yeah, it's a possibility. And like, that's how Dr. Strangelove stands the test of time, because it is, yes, it's based on the Cold War mutual assured destruction propaganda and everything, but it's still a fear, right? Like, it's still that looming threat of at any moment a massive war can happen, and what happens to the rest of the world?
Mm-hmm. Yep. So that's Dr. Strangelove. If you haven't seen it, watch it. If you have seen it, watch it again, because it's just so good. Love Dr. Strangelove. Love everything about it. And man, I always say this now that we're down to this, but it's like, is that going to move up? Is that going to creep into my top 10? At one point, I think I had it at like number 7 or number 8 on like a previous iteration of my top 100. If I could find that list, this was before the days of Letterboxd where everything was nice and neat. But I could see Dr. Strangelove moving back into my top 10 for sure, because I sat there with a smile on my face the whole time and I was like, this movie is just, it's the best satire ever written. There's no question about that. It is the best satire ever written.
Yep.
And it's 95 minutes long. So stop making 2 hours and 25 minute Netflix movies called Don't Look Up, please, for the love of God. All right, John, what was the best movie you watched this week?
The best movie I watched this week was Tar. I finally got around to it. I know some people had expressed to me they weren't sure if I was going to love or hate that movie. I loved it. It was absolutely incredible. Cate Blanchett's performance is absolutely phenomenal. There's no question in my mind that she wins Best Actress this year. Her performance is absolutely spectacular. The film, there were a lot of moments in the films where I was like, is this the best movie that came out this year? It lost me a bit towards the end. But fantastic, wonderful film. I definitely understand why it's getting the Best Picture nom, and you guys should watch it. It doesn't, a lot of people fear that it's like this slog because it's like 2.5 hours long, and the opening 20 minutes is an interview between somebody and Kate Blanchett's character, but it didn't feel like 2.5 hours at all.
I love Todd Field. He's 2 for 2 in my book, so I need to watch this one. He only did In the Bedroom and Little Children. I love both of them, so I'll watch it. But the only other movie I watched this week was Triangle of Sadness, and I really liked it. I thought it was really good. That's a fun satire. You know, as we're talking about satire, that's a really fun one. The shitting and vomiting, 10 out of 10. It's so much. Dolly De Leon, I thought would have gotten a nomination for sure. Also, super depressing. Did you ever look up you watch Triangle of Sadness yet?
I did, yeah.
Okay. Did you look up what ended up happening to Charlby Dean Creek?
No.
The one who plays Yaya?
No.
Oh, yeah. She died in real life.
Oh, no. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's terrible. So she had like some crazy car accident when she was younger. Mm-hmm. And I was reading about this because I was like, what else has she been in? Like, she has to be in something. Because I, you know, she's clearly wasn't like an American actress. So it's just like, what else is she in? She got in some crazy car accident where she had to have her spleen removed. And then got some really rare infection that literally killed her over the course of like 24 hours in October. And it went so unnoticed, which is crazy because Triangle of Sadness won the Cannes Film Festival Award, the Palme d'Or, I think it won.
Yeah,
it did win the Palme d'Or. And so, like, you would have thought that that would have been huge news, and I had no idea. So I just looked up. I wanted to see what everybody else was in, because obviously Woody Harrelson's really the only one who's, like, famous in this movie. And I was like, oh, my God, that's terrible. I mean, it was really depressing. She's only, like, 32 years old or something like that. So it was depressing, but it's a great movie. Her performance is great. I thought Harris Dickinson was really good. Dolly De Leon, I thought, was the best part. And then, actually, I thought the best part of the movie was the old communist, or the non-communist, capitalist Russian was, I thought, the best part of the movie. But, of course, he's not going to get an Oscar nomination because I can't remember his name. Zlatko Bjurek. He's not going to get an Oscar nomination because nobody's ever heard of him. So he's not going to pick that up, but he was great. He was really, really good. Just a fun satire about just like wealth and everything.
Yeah. It was fun.
A lot of messages going on there from Ausland.
Yes. I really enjoyed it. You have to get to that halfway point, I think, because like up to that point, it's like, okay, is this movie really good? And then it just kicks into high gear for the back half of the film.
Yep. Yeah, I agree. And now Ruben Östlund, that's like the movies he's made so far. He made The Square. He made Force Majeure. Like, so this is definitely his best received one, but all his movies are about like class and government and where you fit in and all that fun stuff. So anyway, you got your Fargo. It's your turn.
We have Fargo. Speaking of disclaimers, before movies, this one also has a disclaimer stating that it's a true story, and it's probably one of the most infamous disclaimers that the Coen brothers have ever put out, and like people quote it all the time with like the out of respect for the dead, we kept everything else the same. And of course eventually the Coen brothers had to admit to everyone that it wasn't a true story, but it was marketed that way,
and the TV show ended up using the same line at the beginning of every single episode.
It's so important because what the Coen brothers do with Fargo, what they do, they take probably the most alien part of America in the Midwest, and they put it on full display here. So much so that this is exactly what everyone thinks the Midwest is like now. Like, and yeah, it's somewhat accurate, like the Minnesota accent of it all and everything, and the friendliness, I mean, we in Canada kind of count Minnesota as part of Canada a lot of the times.
We try to. We don't want.
Yeah, I know. But everything about this movie is so fantastic. The casting for this movie is incredible. Obviously, Frances McDormand is married to Joel Coen at this point. Then you have Steve Buscemi in a role that was literally written for him, which is why it feels a lot like just a more toned down Mr. Pink. And then you have William H. Macy, who fought tooth and nail to get this role. And the performances all throughout, even like to the smaller performances with who is it that plays
John Carroll Lynch, Peter Stormare.
John Carroll Lynch, yeah. And like even like John Carroll Lynch's small performance as this retired cop who's painting and married to Marge, and literally he's either in bed or eating in every scene he's in this movie. And all these performances just come together to create this crime film that is absolutely hilarious.
It is. It's a very funny movie. And the Coen brothers had to do a lot of fighting themselves for this movie. Yeah. So obviously, the Coen brothers, Blood Simple came out in 84. So this was 12 years after that movie. But so they had Blood Simple, Raising Arizona, Miller's Crossing, Barton Fink. Those were all really, really, really successful movies. They were putting themselves really onto the map. And they made the Hudsucker Proxy, which was a box office bomb. And it didn't do well. And so when they wanted to make Fargo, they had this idea. And to me, this is when the Coen brothers really became the Coen brothers. Because I like Miller's Crossing. I like Blood Simple. I like Barton Fink. I mean, I like Raising Arizona. I think that's the worst of the bunch. I think that movie's a little overrated. But I like those movies. But this is the movie. This is quintessential Coen brothers. And this No Country for Old Men is this, but in Texas. You know what I mean? Yeah. And so, but what I love about this movie is how hard they had to fight for the decisions that they ended up making. Number one, 32 minutes without Marge Gunderson. You go 32 minutes without Marge Gunderson. And all I can do is roll my eyes whenever you sit in a screenwriting class or any type of story writing class. And these people who are teaching you, who might have been published once or twice, or maybe they've made a movie here and there, and maybe they made a movie recently. Who knows? But it gets so old when they sit there. No. Your first one has to be like this. It has to follow this trajectory. It has to do this. It has to do that. It has to be straightforward. It can't be whatever. Okay. That's, I think, how it was back in the 90s. But I think the 90s changed everything. And I think nowadays you see it a little bit more often where people with their first movie just start with Charlotte Wells, right? With After Sun, which I still haven't watched. But that doesn't follow a normal structure like a lot of movies do. And we saw Tarantino do it with Reservoir Dogs and all that. The 90s really changed that game, and it feels like Hollywood is having a hard time catching up to what the 90s laid before them. The 90s gave great opportunity because the 90s allowed for people like Paul Thomas Anderson and Wes Anderson and the Coen brothers. And as I just said, and whose name I can't remember, whatever movie Tarantino. I just talked about 3 seconds ago. What was it?
Tarantino.
Thank you. Quentin Tarantino. Yeah, that's the other, that schmuck. So yeah, that guy who's useless. So those four, like, it gave way to those movies. And I think some people have found a way to make that work and build a career out of it. I think we see it with Ari Aster, and we've seen it with, I can't think of his name. Who did The Northman?
Eggers.
Thank you. I can never remember Eggers' name. But Eggers is phenomenal. And these guys always manage to do what they want to do and find the backing, find the financial backing behind it. And that's great. So when I look at this, and I see what's going on with Fargo, and getting back to my initial point, because I'm going on tangents and I'm, you know, in Super Bowl brain because we're doing this Super Bowl Sunday. So I can only half remember how to get back to them. With the Coen brothers, they fought to make sure their main character didn't have to be in this movie right away. Mm-hmm. And if you sit in any screenwriting class, if you sit in any writing class, if you tell them, because, and I'm going to go grab this because this is important, but I'm going to read the back of the DVD case for Fargo, because I have it in my living room right now and I'm going to go grab it. But if you were to read that to them and then say, also Marge Gunderson doesn't come in until 32 minutes into the movie, they'd say, and how long is the movie? 98 minutes. Yeah, fuck you. You can't do that. You see, and it's not, that's not going to work. It's, you can't do that. Mm-hmm. That won't get made. And yet it has so many times. So I'm going to go grab that box. John, you talk.
Yeah, for sure. And one of the big things with this movie is that sets it up immediately to show, like, it doesn't matter that Marge Gunderson doesn't come in until half an hour in, because you have this very compelling storyline of Jerry Lundegaard just, you know, hiring these two guys in Fargo, North Dakota, which, I mean, we have to talk about the fact that this movie's called Fargo and it doesn't take place in Fargo at all.
The first three minutes, that's it.
Yeah, that's it. But it compels you and you want to follow along. And then you don't even realize that it has that cop element until we do get to that point where Marge Gunderson's introduced. And then Marge Gunderson's just like one of the most quintessential cops of the 90s.
Maybe in film. I mean, Marge Gunderson might be like one of the five or six most iconic cops in film history. And I'm talking like with Popeye Doyle from French Connection. And like, she's on that level. Everybody knows pregnant Marge, who just keeps saying, "You betcha," and "Yeah, yeah, yeah." Like, everybody knows her. That scene where she's talking to the prostitutes, I mean, that is iconic. Iconic.
Yeah.
Okay, so here, I have the back of this. So here you go. Things go terribly awry when small-time Minnesota car salesman Jerry Lundegaard hires two thugs to kidnap his wife so he can collect the ransom from his wealthy father-in-law. Once people start dying, the very chipper and very pregnant police chief Marge takes the case. Will she stop at nothing until she gets her man? You betcha. Right? So that's the back of this. So that sets it up as, here's the setup, and Jerry Lundegaard hires two thugs, and he's your bad guy, and the two thugs are bad guys because they're going to kidnap his wife, and that's so messed up, and they're trying to use it for extortion. And now, is she going to stop at nothing until she gets her man? So we know Marge Gunderson is going to be in this. 32 minutes. She is not in one third of this movie. And you'd be told if you were to write this for a class or something like that, oh, well, at least like introduce her. Let's see her drinking coffee. Let's see her with her husband. Let's do something. The brilliance of this movie is we watch the spiral out of control. How it starts off with a very simple, just kidnap my wife. We're going to get the money and it's no big deal. And that turn, and here's the car that I'm going to give you so that you have it. And that turns into, I forgot to put my tags on. Now we've killed a cop. Now two people have seen us. Now I have to kill those two people. And now we still have the wife and we need to kidnap her. So now we've murdered three people, one of which is a cop. And we've kidnapped a wife and we're driving a stolen vehicle, whatever. I mean, it's just, it's crime all around that vehicle. But all of that going on. And then we see Marge Gunderson wake up and hear, okay, you got to come out and you got to look at this. We already know what she's going to look at. But I think that also helps us because while we're not, this movie isn't about figuring it out alongside of her. This movie is about, is she going to be able to figure it out? And we sit there and realize how intelligent she is because she is figuring it out. I don't like your police work there. DLR, dealer plates, you know, those types of things throughout the entire movie. And what I think is one of the most important scenes in the movie. And they wanted, Gramercy Pictures, whatever that is at this point. I don't even know if they don't exist anymore, but whatever they are, they do. I don't know. They wanted to remove the part with Mike Yamaguchi, I think his last name is. They wanted to remove it. They didn't want it in the movie. Yeah. And the Coen brothers were like, why would we remove the most important scene of our movie? And they're like, that's not the most important scene of your movie.
But it is.
And they were like, of course it's the most important scene of the movie because and they had to explain it to producers. And they're like, without that scene, she never goes back to re-question Jerry Lundegaard.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh. And like, yeah. She goes, she trusts him, she feels bad for him, she thinks everything's clear, and then she gets on the phone and she realizes she got duped. And then she says, who else is duping me right now? And she goes back to see Jerry Lundegaard, and that's what sends the whole third act into motion.
Yeah, it's wild because you do watch this movie and it's hard to pick up on the first time if you're not paying attention and you don't understand that. But that phone call is so important because it just tells her that she's kind of written off Jerry because let's be real. Jerry's kind of a bumbling buffoon. Mm-hmm. Like this character just seems like he doesn't have anything together. He's caught up in something that has got like he is way over his head. Not only with like, you know, the kidnapping of his wife and stuff, but the reason he needs that money in the first place, he's already caught up in something. We know he's like trying to rip people off for cars that don't exist.
Yep.
And we as an audience understand what's going on. And that's the brilliance of why this scene works so well. It's because we know that Marge should go after him, but Marge doesn't. And that's when we get that phone call. And we find out that Mike Iannacchino lied about being married to this woman.
Yeah, there it is.
Because he was like obsessed with her and like kind of stalking her. Mm-hmm. At that point, Marge has that realization. If this person who I knew already is lying to me. What's preventing Jerry Lundegaard from lying to me?
Yep. Yep. And especially with how sketchy of a person Jerry Lundegaard is. When people talk about villains, Jerry Lundegaard never comes up. Jerry Lundegaard is one of the biggest pieces of shit in film history. Because the problem with Jerry Lundegaard is Jerry Lundegaard's a very real person. Jerry Lundegaard is somebody that you could accidentally be passing on the street on your way to the grocery store or going to the movie theater or something like that. This is a guy who's a total loser, who married above himself, and who will do anything to make a buck, and now it's got him in debt. Like you said, he's way over his head. So what does he do? He decides he's going to have his wife kidnapped so he can get the ransom money from her father.
Her father-in-law.
And the best part is he's going to pay these guys $40,000 and give them a car. And he's trying to get $1 million because that's how much of debt he's in. What did you say you're going to need if I have to give you these cars if you can't give us the right serial numbers, $320,000, not going to be able to give you anymore. Like, we realize how much trouble Jerry Lundegaard is in. And this guy stops at nothing throughout the entire movie to do every single thing for himself. He is not interested in the benefit of his family, of his wife, of his son, of his father-in-law. Everything is about him. And that one part where it's, how's Scotty doing? And he goes, oh, Scotty. It's almost like he forgot. And then he goes home and he doesn't give a shit how Scotty's doing, because it's not about Scotty. It's about Jerry Lundegaard. William H. Macy plays this role to perfection. Mm-hmm. Lost the Oscar to Cuba Gooding Jr. for Jerry Maguire because he screams, show me the money, a bunch of times. It's the only reason Cuba Gooding Jr. won that Oscar. William H. Macy in this movie could have been up for lead actor. He is phenomenal in this role. And Jerry Lundegaard is one of the most despicable characters ever put on film. And I really believe that, because if you look at the other movies that the Coen brothers made before this, I really believe that Jerry Lundegaard, more so than even Marge Gunderson, is the reason the Coen brothers became what they became. Because they don't really have another Marge Gunderson throughout the rest of their filmography. They have a lot of Jerry Lundegaards.
They do. They like that idea of the everyman who kind of just like bumbles his way through things.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Like, even if we look at like what the Big Lebowski was their next movie. Mm-hmm. You can't tell me the dude is not just Jerry Lundegaard in a different part of the country.
Yeah. And he's a better guy. That's all. He's just a nicer guy.
Yeah. And it's really interesting how this movie works. And the setting, again, like going back to the setting of the Midwest, I had this realization while watching this. Marge Gunderson is a noble savage.
A noble savage, says John.
Yeah.
Explain.
Okay, so noble savage is this character archetype that we have in film, right? Where it's someone who's alien and foreign, but they all have these like altruistic things. Thinking of characters like Tom Hanks's character in The Terminal would be considered like a noble savage, right? Mm-hmm. And despite the fact that this movie takes place in America, the Midwest seems so foreign to the rest of America that Marge Gunderson still falls into this character archetype.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And I think what explains that is at the end, after she finds Stomar putting Steve Buscemi in the wood chipper, which is just brilliant. I mean, that when that happened in 1996, I mean, I was only 4 years old, but I remember when I finally turned like 10, 11, that's all my dad and his friends would talk about was, like when they put the guy in the wood chipper, like, you know, you grow up in the Northeast, wood chippers are all around the neighborhood all the time. And every time you saw one, all you thought about was the foot with the sock on it being rammed in there. But I think you're right. And what gives it away is after she catches him and puts him in the back of the car and she's explaining everything to him. And she goes, and it's a beautiful day. Mm-hmm. I just don't understand it. And I think what this movie is about, right, more than anything, is what do we, as much as the coasts really control America, when you think of America more so than any other country, and I mean, I know you live in a country where there's nothing but land, but more so than any other country, you think about the middle of this country where there is the rolling hills and the plains, and you think of buffalo and bison and like all of those like really Americanized things that you can't have in Europe, that they have in certain parts of Asia, but you just don't hear about it as much. Like, South America has the rainforest. America has the middle of the country. Like, the United States of America has the middle of this country. And the only reason that the middle of this country exists is because of manifest destiny. There was no reason for anybody who settled in America to ever cross the Mississippi River. There was no reason. There is nothing beyond the Mississippi River. I've driven across this country three times. After you get past the Mississippi River, it is nothing until you get to California. Because, and even when you're in California, you're like, holy shit, it's just the desert. Like, what the hell? Before they started building up cities and stuff, there was nothing there. Nothing lives there. Nothing lives in the desert. But that's what people remember. And then when you're pushing the indigenous people out there and all that, all that's going on. And what this movie is, I think, about is the greed of America. The greed of going into those areas and building up these places and chasing that money and trying to do anything you can to make a quick buck and screwing over you ever have to screw over so that you can make that quick buck and blah, blah, blah. And you're right. Marge Gunderson doesn't fit into that. Because Marge Gunderson is all about, I don't understand. Why do you want more than what you have? You live in this place that's beautiful. And it's freaking white and it's miserable and it's cold. And I live in Florida and I don't want to think about living in Minnesota or North Dakota. But it's that feeling of, do you not realize, like, if you would have just kept doing what you're doing and did the right thing, you could have had what I have. And she goes home and that last scene is so great of her just laying down. And it's just, oh, 2 more months. Yeah, 2 more. They don't even discuss the case. That she's not the one who catches Jerry Lundegaard. None of that. She just goes and she goes home with her husband and she just goes to sleep.
Well, and that closing scene where they're talking about the 3-cent stamp, right? Mm-hmm. Like the fact that the painting's on the three cent stamp. Mm-hmm. And Marge's outlook on it is just, yeah, when they change the price of postage, though, everyone needs those small stamps.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Like be happy with what you're accomplishing. You don't need to be the biggest deal in the world. You can just be something.
She's such a fantastic character. And Frances McDormand obviously does an absolutely amazing job in this role. But this character just, it makes you feel better about the world around you, despite the fact that we're seeing violent crimes committed the entire movie.
The entire movie. But she doesn't care that even when she's looking at it and he's like, oh, are you okay, Margie? No. It's just the morning sickness. Moving on.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not throwing up because I'm looking at this person who got shot. Because she can remove herself from it. Because she knows that her life is fine. She doesn't get eaten up by it. Her life's about to get better while everybody else's life is going to shit. And I just don't understand it. And I think that's the great thing, right? Because No Country for Old Men, which goes on to win Best Picture 11 years after this one, very similar storyline, very similar part of the country, even though now this one's set in the South in Texas, in the desert, which the desert and the plains of North Dakota, the only thing different about them is one's green and the other's yellow, but there's nothing there. You know, that's a part of America that just hasn't been built up. And it's kind of creepy sometimes when you go through it. Like, these types of things feel like they could happen anytime when you're in those areas. But No Country for Old Men, very similar. Tommy Lee Jones isn't in the first 45 minutes of the movie, 45 minutes of the movie. And it's all about how he just doesn't understand these people anymore. He just doesn't get it. What is the purpose of this? Why do you want that? Why do you need to go and do, like, I just don't get it. And once you stop being able to understand it, what are you even fighting to protect anymore? And I feel like that's what Fargo is. Like, once she can't even fathom why anybody would do what anybody in this movie does. Because what, for a little bit of money, you realize there's a lot more to life than a little bit of money. And where did the $1 million end up? Sorry, $920,000 end up? Buried in the snow.
Buried in the snow.
That's it.
Okay, you find out where it is in Fargo season one.
Yes, 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 yes. It is. It is done. Yeah, Fargo season one is not an addition to this movie. It is more of just like it's like an ode to this movie.
Yes.
The retelling, sort of.
Kind of. Yeah, it's weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, but like, there's so many, the general niceness of everyone who we're supposed to be rooting for in this movie just makes you hope that this world is better than it is. And it's that contrast that the Coen brothers get here, especially with, like, I love the fact that everything's covered in snow in this movie and mm-hmm. almost all of it's artificial because it was the warmest winter Minnesota had ever had.
Yeah.
To that date.
Yep. Yeah. And they have to saturate the backgrounds, oversaturate mm-hmm. the camera so that everything stays white because it wasn't that white.
Yeah. And it's just like, it's those contrasts, and especially because we do get those city shots that reminds you of everything. And then we get the vast shots, even some of those city shots. If you look at, like, the overhead parking lot shots, like, it's that contrast of, like, the side view of the city to the emptiness of a parking lot are just so contrasting to each other that they really hits home the isolation of the Midwest.
The isolation of the Midwest is captured perfectly in this movie. The Coen brothers really know how to capture that because they grew up in the middle of nowhere, Texas. So they're really able to capture that isolation of middle America where you just feel like there's nothing around and there's nothing for you. And what are you going to do? I mean, their two best movies, in my opinion, do that.
Yeah, exactly.
So here's a fun little trivia fact for you, John. I hope you didn't look it up already. But so Joel and Ethan Coen won best screenplay for this movie. It was, you know, original screenplay.
Yeah.
That year, do you know who won best screenplay for adapted?
Was it The English Patient?
No, it was not. The English Patient lost. It was one of the few things that The English Patient lost. It was Billy Bob Thornton for Sling Blade. So I just think it's interesting that in 1996, the Coen brothers win original, Billy Bob Thornton wins adapted. And then in 2014, Billy Bob Thornton is the main character in the Fargo TV anthology.
That is interesting.
It's just like, again, when I'm talking about like all these things you hear when you go into these classes and, oh, you can't do this, you can't do that, you got to follow this structure, you got to do that. Like I said, the 90s just gave way to people. Sling Blade is such a unique movie. Fargo is such a unique movie. And these guys built massive freaking careers out of this. Massive careers out of what they were doing. And they were doing something different. And Sling Blade, if I'm not mistaken, and I could be mistaken, but if I'm not mistaken, Sling Blade was the first movie where Billy Bob Thornton actually got like a legitimate role. Because before that, I'm pretty sure he was all just like really side characters. Now, I could be wrong, but I'm looking at his filmography and there's nothing there really. And then when he did Sling Blade, all of a sudden he became a star. Yeah. I just figured it's an interesting thing to look at.
Well, while we're speaking about the Oscars this year, this is one of the biggest best picture snubs ever, right?
So yes, but I will say this. I actually like The English Patient, which I'm one of the rare people who does. I like it. It's a 3-star movie. Like it's not a great movie, but it's a 3-star movie. I actually like The English Patient. I think it's a really nice story. Mm-hmm. But yeah, this was also during a time period where when you really kind of look back at the 90s, there were a lot of Oscar snubs. This was Fargo losing The English Patient. The next year you have Titanic beating LA Confidential. The year after that you have Shakespeare in Love beating Saving Private Ryan, which I think was correct, but still it happened. And then in 94, you even have Forrest Gump beating Pulp Fiction and Shawshank Redemption. Like this was kind of the decade where Braveheart wins in 95. I don't really remember what should have won. Like Apollo 13 was a movie people thought should have won in 95, but Braveheart should have won. But they were kind of going for these bigger period piece type things. Mm-hmm. I actually think The English Patient is a pretty good movie. Dr. Strangelove to me is a bigger snub going against My Fair Lady than I think this is going against The English Patient. I think The English Patient is a perfectly fine movie, and had The English Patient not won Best Picture, I actually think it'd be a lot better received in today's world. But yes, I agree with you. Like Fargo 100% should have been the Best Picture winner that year. And really, I just think it comes down to the fact that the Coen brothers weren't what the Coen brothers were yet. Because if they win here, they probably lose in 2007 and Paul Thomas Anderson probably takes it home for There Will Be Blood.
That's true. What a shame that is. But we'll get to that in a couple weeks.
Have you seen Sling Blade or no?
I have not. I had never heard of it until you just said it.
Really?
Yeah.
You should watch Sling Blade, Billy Bob Thornton's first Oscar nomination. He wins for screenplay and he was nominated for Best Actor.
Oh wow.
That's a great movie. That is a great, great movie. Also very weird, but a great, great movie. Robert Duvall's in it. I think John Ritter's in it. Is John Ritter? Yeah, John Ritter's in it. Dwight Yoakam. A very, very good movie from 1996. And it was based, he wrote a short story. And directed the movie. And it's just a really short movie. I don't know if you can even find it online now. And then he adapted it into a feature length and the rest is history because Billy Bob Thornton blew up after that.
Yeah, I'd never heard of it. I'll have to give it a watch.
Now you have. But anyway, you have anything else you want to say about Fargo?
No, just watch it. Again, like we're just at that point where we're just going to tell you to watch every single one of our movies. If you've seen it, if you haven't seen it, watch it.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, well, next week, we're number 12. And that's going to be Baby Driver from 2017 and Psycho from 1960. So John keeps it a little bit more relevant than I do, just like he's done the last couple weeks. But that's okay. Psycho from 1960, the Alfred Hitchcock one. I can't imagine that anybody's going to complain about watching a Hitchcock movie. And then Baby Driver from 2017, which is, of course, Edgar Wright. And was that the last movie that was released theatrically with Kevin Spacey in it?
I think so.
Close to, if not. Close it was the to. Last one that was well-received, if it wasn't the last one that was released. But there's a trivia for you. What was the last movie with Kevin Spacey released in theaters? But anyway, so yeah, we'll be talking Baby Driver. And I'm excited. So we'll be – do we have a date set for that yet? We don't, right?
We said the 20th, I believe. Monday.
Okay, right? So we're going to be doing that the 20th. Okay. So a little bit over a week. Thank you all for listening. Hope you enjoyed it. Follow us on Letterboxd to see what we're watching. We'll keep talking about movies as I actually try to finish out these Best Picture nominees for this year. I think I have four left. And that's it. That's it. We'll see you next time.
Bye.